Hello and welcome to Table Talk, Spectator Life's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Nora Prendergast.
And today we are joined by Sarah Langford. Sarah is a barrister and author of the best-selling In Your Defence, Stories of Life and Law, which follows 11 real-life cases in the criminal and family courts. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sarah, we'll start where we always start on this podcast. You grew up in Winchester. What was food like when you were little?
Classic 80s fare, I'd say, because I'm the eldest of three girls. My mum was a primary school teacher, so she worked. And I think, you know, I think in the 80s, we just knew less about nutrition, maybe. And so our diet predominantly came from the freezer. So most suppers would have gone straight from the freezer into the oven and then onto our plate, which, you know, now all of the mummy blogs with all of their kind of healthy recipes would be aghast at. But then I think it was pretty standard. Spaghetti hoops on toast, chicken nuggets, mash, that kind of stuff. Quite a lot of brown stuff.
Did you learn to cook when you were little?
No. So my mum, interestingly, my mum is completely uninterested in food or cooking until the last couple of years where she's really got into it. And I don't know if that's because you can get recipes online. Recipes are just much more accessible. Mm. There's a big thing. There's much more, I think, of a sort of big thing about provenance and where our food comes from and we are what we eat in a way that I just don't think there was when I was growing up. We just didn't have that same connection unless you were in the food world anyway, which we definitely were not. So I did not learn to cook, but my granny, who my maternal grandmother, was a kind of cook of her era. So she was a farmer's wife and therefore had to churn out a farm tea and two hot meals a day. Which was a job in itself, along with, you know, keeping sort of various farm animals alive and things like that. So she did kind of classic post-war cooking involving a lot of lard and baking and that kind of cooking, old-fashioned cooking, which I used to watch her doing all the time. So I have really kind of fond memories of that kitchen.
What sort of things would she make?
You'd open the fridge and there would be one of those ceramic, old-fashioned kind of ceramic bowls with lard in it. Mm. That she'd drain the fat off and then put it in the fridge to cool and then reuse it.
Dripping.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's such an 80s thing, isn't it?
She used to bake a lot, so I have really kind of fond memories of kind of doing plaited bread and bread shapes and different kinds of bread with her, and pies and meat. You know, you could never have a meal without meat. It would have been unthinkable. So there's a lot of kind of pork chops and joints and roasts and stuff like that.
Yum.
And did they still have farming animals when you were little?
Yeah, so my uncle's now running the farm and it's part arable, part beef.
Right.
But ironically, I didn't eat meat until I was 12.
Really? Why? Was that a family-wide thing or just you?
No, it was just me. And as the sort of granddaughter of a beef farmer, wow. It was, I don't remember it being that controversial actually. I just didn't like the texture, I think.
Mm.
So they were quite indulgent. I mean, my mum was quite indulgent. She never used to make us eat stuff that we didn't want to, thinking that it would all kind of come out in the wash, which
it did.
It has. Yeah. I eat everything. So she was right, I think, to do that. But I do remember she said I lived off baked beans and Ribena until I was about 10. And then I was really kind of gangly and skinny with big ears and big teeth. And she took me to the doctor. And the doctor went, well, I mean, she's alive. She's right.
Classic 80s.
So pragmatic. And I remember I'd have my Sunday roast, if we went over for a Sunday roast, would be a lump of cheddar cheese with a Yorkshire pudding and the vegetables and gravy on top of it.
That's amazing.
I know. So they were very indulgent with it. And I don't remember particularly the transition. I think my gateway meat was chicken, probably.
Right.
Mm. And then
Was it something at school that you sort of then had to start eating meat?
Or maybe. I don't kind of consciously remember thinking, I'm just going to have a steak now.
Mm. But it happened at
but
some
point. But it definitely
point.
Yeah. happened at some point. It definitely happened at some point. And I think that's probably informed the way that I feed my kids, because I really want them to try stuff, but I won't force them to if they try it and then don't like it. Because I think it all ends up, you end up coming out the other side fine, I think.
Yeah, rather than attaching emotive ideas
so.
To it all.
I think so. I think, you know, you probably come out as you are, and if you're inclined one way or another, then that will come out. But I think you can probably put too much emphasis on you have to finish your plate.
Mm. And what about school food? Do you have happy memories of school food?
Well, because I was so fussy. But again, I think when I was at school, it was 90s. And so although the school I went to up until I was 16 definitely prided themselves on their menu, but I don't remember it being particularly exotic. But it was clearly more, you know, it was kind of baked potatoes and beans and cheddar. And
perfect.
Stew and stuff like that. Fish pie again.
It fits more Sarah's diet perfectly.
It did. It did. I wore terrible braces. I still kind of think of them as some kind of child abuse, because do you remember the metal
train tracks?
Yeah. And the little rubber bands.
Oh, my. But they're attached from one, you know, your upper jaw to your lower jaw. It was mental to have a rubber band, meaning that you can open your mouth properly. And then a head brace at night.
Oh, God.
Which was straight out of a torture film. And so food was quite a challenge because you would get it stuck in your metal train tracks.
Surrounded by your peers.
Surrounded, fishing out a bit of green leaf. It was not a good look. So, I mean, I think I sort of stuck to quite soft, simple food because my mouth was full of metal for a really long time.
You left home for university.
I did. I went travelling first.
Right.
So
where'd you go?
I went on the kind of cliche round the world trip.
Right.
So we started in Vancouver, Hawaii, Fiji, New Zealand and Australia.
Wow.
Which now I kind of think back, I was literally just 19 when I went. No mobile phones and working visa. And that was off I went. And it was brilliant. Because I think it taught me all kinds of lessons that I realised later, like resilience and the ability to pitch up in a country by yourself and not know anyone and not have any money and get a job, which...
What were you working as?
Well, in Australia, which is where I worked, in a hostel where I would get up, get in the bus at about 5 o'clock in the morning, go to the bus station, try and coax travellers to come back to the hostel, cook them pancakes for breakfast, and then go to my other job, which was telesales.
Wow.
And then door-to-door sales on 100% commission, selling overseas phone lines, which of course generally for people who can't speak English, so I wasn't very good at it. And then in the evening I ran neighbours nights.
What's that?
Where you get people from neighbours to do a pub quiz.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Well, actors from Neighbours.
Actors from Neighbours.
Wow.
So, of course, everyone in the audience is British. They would come and read out Bingo or something.
I mean, I would go to that. I would 100% go to that.
Very popular. It was very popular. And, you know, there were some Neighbours stars that took advantage of the adoration.
Yes.
But they had to get banned for kind of inappropriate deeds and disabled loos. But it was... You can edit that for now, it's all right.
What listeners can't see is that Cindy, the producer, has just lost it. That
it was very fun. It was a lot of fun. And it was... But, I mean, in terms of food, I ate appallingly bad.
I was going to say, I mean, did it open your mind, or were you on so little money that...
So little money. It was like noodles all the way. I do remember being in Queensland, I think, and I had so little money that the only thing I could afford was 6 bread rolls for 2 days.
With nothing else.
So I remember I stashed them under my dorm bed, and that was all I lived on for about 2 days, was 6 bread rolls. But it was a good, you know, good education. It sounds great.
Just not a culinary one.
It's not, definitely not. I mean, you come back 3 times the size that you left because you're on beer and noodles for a year.
And what about university foods? Did you...
That mainly stayed the same.
Beer and noodles.
It was. I suppose, you know, this is always going to be the tension between cheap food generally being not that good for you.
Mm.
And food that is good for you, like vegetables and fruit, being really expensive. I do remember in Australia deciding with the girl that I kind of travelled with for some of it that we should stop eating so badly. And we found this kind of supermarket that's doing loads of special offer deals. So we bought, you know, potatoes and vegetables and fruit and all these kind of things to make good food out of. But of course, because we were traveling, we had nowhere to put them. So we just carried them around in like three black bin liners for about a week before we ended up going, I don't think we can carry this for much longer. We had to ditch them. It's completely pointless. But I mean, you know, if you're trying to survive on a very limited budget, then I'm afraid generally it's stuff that lasts a long time and stuff that doesn't cost very much that you get, which is, you know, the tension in the kind of political difficulty surrounding food and cost of meat and stuff like that. I think we should end up paying more for our meat.
Yes. And after university, you decided you were going to become a barrister.
Yes.
But you took, I mean, a sort of hospitality route into
it.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't come from the world of law at all. I mean, as discussed, my maternal grandparents were farmers and my uncle's still a farmer. Has his own column, Farmers Weekly, Flint on Friday.
Amazing.
And my dad's side were in the army. And so I didn't know any barristers. And it was a friend of mine who said, look, you should try this, because the three vital elements for being a barrister are ones that you like. You'd love showing off, you'd like dressing up, and you like words. So that's a pretty powerful trio.
That sounds perfect,
yes. As we know. And so I went home and lived with my parents for another year or two, or a bit more, and got a job in a local pub, which was a pub that I had worked in on and off since I was about 16. And there were loads of barristers that used to go there. It was nicknamed the Watering Hole of the Western Circuit. So all the barristers and judges that were up the road in Winchester Crown Court used to stay in there and drink there. So I co-opted the manager and said, I don't know, Annie, could you introduce me to someone? She was really game and went, yes. So I did that in the evenings and then worked as a legal secretary during the day, which again was really a really good way of seeing a case all the way through and of seeing it from the other side.
Mm. And when you started training for the bar, one of the requirements are dining sessions.
Yes.
Can you tell us about those and how you found them?
So, as Libby knows, it comes from an old tradition that took place when there was no formal legal education. So you used to have to go to various dining sessions in one of four inns of court, which you have to join to become a barrister. And they've, now that you can go to do your actual bar course, they've maintained the tradition, but the numbers have dwindled down to 12. But you still have to go to 12 dining sessions a year.
Used to be many more than
that. Used to be many
there?
More. Yeah. And the idea was that you would sit opposite people that you would get to know who might give you a job in their chambers.
Which is now hugely frowned upon.
You're a jolly good chap. Maybe you should come to me. It
goes against all the HR practices nowadays.
There's a lot of clubbability.
Yes.
And that you also would have something called challenging, which is after you have finished dining, you would ask for permission to smoke, as was the day then. And then somebody would stand on their chair and say, I would like to challenge Miss Potts to explain the colour of her skirt today. And then you would have to stand on your chair and reply and do it in some kind of verbose language, hopefully with a bit of Latin thrown in as well. And then somebody would come up with who won and set you a forfeit. And by the time I was there, they had banned it in every inn apart from mine.
Were you at Grace?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
So you still had to do this?
I don't think they do anymore now.
No, they don't do it anymore, which some people kind of lament.
I don't.
I mean, I don't know about you, but you would, you know, the rap would go on the table and you'd go, can I make a break for it?
Yeah.
Should I sneak out now? You'd slip slowly down and you're...
I think it makes it far harder to open up the bar to different demographics if you have that kind of old-fashioned, slightly cringeworthy and intimidating. I'm not going to call it hazing, but some level of hazing. So I'm anti it, but I know there are a lot of people who still miss it.
I think, yeah, and I I guess the basis of it is that you're supposed to want to be an advocate, and here's your chance. But it was also it was quite heavy-handed. Mm. But I do remember Clarissa Dixon Wright was a member of Grays, yeah. And she used to go to those nights all the time. And I remember her winning a forfeit or losing one or something and doing the polka all the way down the middle of Grays Inn.
And what was the food like at those dining sessions?
I mean, it was old school, kind of meat in some sort of stewy gravy with some vegetables and something fancy, and then a lot of port. I just remember there being a lot of port, which is not something I think I'd ever drunk before in my life.
No, and you had to sit in groups of four, didn't you?
You sit in quads.
Quads, and you had to sort of toast to each side.
This kind of, it was like a different world. I mean, it was.
Because you wrote in the Guardian last year, you wrote about sort of people, when you talk to them about being a barrister and what they imagine your life is like, and that probably sounds a bit like what people can imagine a barrister's life is like, but presumably your reality kind of day-to-day is quite different to that. So take us through your day, and what sort of food would you be encountering during a normal day?
I mean, that was one of the kind of reasons I wanted to write the book, was because I think what I would see on screen and sometimes what I would read in memoirs would be this kind of very glamorous upper end of the bar where everyone was constantly in a black taxi wearing red lipstick and very high heels on the way to the Royal Courts of Justice, which was not my experience.
No.
My experience would be getting up very early, leaving the house in the dark with a wheelie bag and a pair of trainers and heels in your wheelie bag, and then getting on a train to some
somewhere
town
remote
that you may never go to again. Mm. And so I was on the, I'm on the Western Circuit, which means that a week could be Bristol on Monday, Swindon on Tuesday, Isle of Wight on Thursday, Reading on Friday. I've left out a day somewhere.
That's right. You're probably on papers that day.
Quite a lot of different. And will these all be different cases?
Cases. And so you spend a lot of time on trains and you spend a lot of time alone. And unless you're super organised and do things like pack lunches, which I'm afraid is just not in my blood, then you ate out of vending machines.
Yeah.
So usually I would, you know, get a coffee. I mean, when I first started, I thought having a takeaway coffee was probably the most luxurious thing you could ever have in your life. A few years in, I realised what a necessity it was. But you would get a coffee. I'd get a coffee from the train station, get on the train to whatever court. As soon as you get there, you meet your client. Probably for the first time, you have your hours conference with them. And then if you have a trial first thing, then you're off and running. And you don't really get breaks. I mean, the court breaks, but you spend those breaks talking to your client or your solicitor or whatever other prep that you've got to do. So the lunch break would usually be you working out what cross-examination you've got to change based on what evidence has come out that morning, or putting together your closing speech with the evidence that you've already heard, or kind of working in a windowless kind of strip-lit room with whatever came out of the vending machine. There used to be, some courts had, as you know, half-decent cafes, but they got fewer and fewer and fewer, and the cafes ended up kind of closing.
Yeah.
So sometimes they would have a little trolley. I think Salisbury ended up, did it?
I never went to Salisbury. That sounds brilliant.
Have a little trolley. But most of the time it was, is it going to be a Kit Kat today or a Snickers? What crisps shall I go? It was very incredibly unhealthy. And the problem is, if you take a packed lunch, because you're not in an office, you can't take your packed lunch in the morning, put it in the fridge or a kitchen,
just sits
and
in
then
a wheelie case.
Empty it onto it. It gets kind of churned around up
you
and down
milk,
steps.
Or cheese by the time.
Yes, you would. It would get bumped about so much that any times I tried it, it would be so limp by the time it got to 1:30 that you wanted to eat from a vending machine anyway.
And presumably, by the time you get home in the evening, you must just be exhausted. I mean, do you ever cook in the evenings, or is that just out of the question?
No, I wouldn't. Well, if I did, it would be kind of straightforward stuff, like an omelette or something simple. But the last thing you really want to do is start chopping and slicing and peeling and, you know, marinating. Mm. You don't really want... I mean, by nature, I'm not a massively organised person, which is why the bar suited me very well, because it's incredibly hand-to-mouth. And you just focus on what's coming next, and then that's out of the way, so you just churn on to the next one. And you're never really encouraged to think much further than what's immediately requiring your attention right then and there. So I very much struggle to think, what am I going to eat tomorrow night and prepare it in advance? I usually, well, it's a bit different now, but I certainly then would not think about it until I realised I was incredibly hungry, and then make something.
And what about drinking? I mean, I suppose given your time working in the pub in Winchester, I mean, is there a very strong drinking culture amongst barristers?
What do you think?
We're both nodding.
Nodding and flushing.
Nodding and flushing.
I think you wrote at some point that there was no support network other than the pub for barristers.
I mean, that. Do you know what? In the last couple of years, that has changed hugely. And I think it has been part of the tumbleweed of Me Too.
Oh, I think it's because of digital briefs. I think people aren't going in to pick up their briefs in paper. But the Me Too is a better argument. I just thought it was because everything was online now. So there wasn't the physical need to go into your chambers and pick them up at 5 p.m.
So would you have to do that before?
You'd do that. If you weren't in a trial, you'd go and you'd be told at sort of 4 p.m. what your case was for the next day, and you would normally, unless you could persuade your clerks to scan it all in for you, you'd have to go and pick up this hard copy brief, and then, you know, you're in chambers right next to the pub at 5 p.m. and so are all your colleagues. But the Me Too, I hadn't thought of that as a...
Well,
as
I was getting my briefs by email for quite some time before I went on maternity leave. So if you had a printer, you could go home.
Yeah.
And if you were in a trial, then you didn't need to go in.
No, that's true.
And because you're on circuit, you know, we've got a big chambers. So we've got one in London, and then I did my pupillage in Winchester, and then we've got several other ones too. But often you are not going back via Temple.
No.
If you're coming from, I don't know, Reading or something like that.
You're just going home.
It's a huge schlep to go in. Yeah. So if you don't need to, you don't. So you might have a little half bottle of train wine with your colleagues on the way home. I mean, that was always actually really fun, especially on a Friday when if you had been doing a trial with lots of people, or if you'd been in a kind of provincial court where there were lots of people that you knew, you would kind of take over several of the quad tables on the way back, and the little trolley would come down and someone would suggest it, and you'd feel you didn't really want to get left out, and then you might trip on somewhere else in Waterloo. And
so has Me Too had a sort of big effect?
Well,
on
I think that what Me Too did was tell people that they could talk about stuff which they thought they couldn't. So obviously it started in the area of kind of sexual assault and inappropriate sexual behaviour, but then I think it kind of also opened up the ability for women to go, I found it really hard to go back after having children, or I don't feel I'm getting paid the same as my male colleagues because I'm doing sex cases all the time and they're doing fraud cases all the time. And I think it gave a platform to people to rock the boat in a way that they had been really reticent to do before. And so I think kind of part of that is the support network. There was no support for barristers because we're all self-employed, so you're on your own. Your support is what you make yourself. And I think in the last couple of years that's become much more formalised. So on the Western Circuit, we have the Western Circuit Women's Forum, who put a focus on how to help women become QCs and judges, fixing them up with a mentor officially, helping women go back after they've had kids. And then there are other kind of, the Bar Council's done much more in terms of a sort of helpline for mental health and stress and stuff, which would, I imagine, cause lots of eyeball rolls 5 years ago, where people thought it was all a bit wet. And now people realise if you want people to hang around in this job, which is really stressful, then you need to help them look after themselves. So that's my own theory. I don't know.
No, I think that is a much more analytical take on it than I know. I've been like, oh, well, there are no paper briefs anymore. But actually what you say makes a lot more sense. And I think there was certainly an idea when I was training that you have to be because you are trying to be taken on for potentially the rest of your career,
yes.
the people who take you on want you to be a colleague that they will spend many more years with, and therefore you have not only to be good in court and good with the law, but also good on the social side.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps that that has changed as well with this, as you say, this sort of formalising of the mentoring and the opening of eyes and fewer rolling eyeballs to the whole system, and that that time spent in the pub is actually not looked on the way it once was for junior barristers.
And I think that's across the bar as well. I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely remember lots of kind of chambers, not so much ours, but other chambers where clerks would go drinking with solicitors for large periods of time at lunch and then arrive back in chambers at about 4:30. That was the way you got briefed. Mm. I mean, the BBC programme Silk did that relatively well. You know, there was a lot of shots in the pub in Silk. And I think that that is also, people are saying, this is not transparent. This is not the way this should happen, really. So that has changed a bit. But yes, the drinking, I think, probably applies to most public sector areas. I think medicine's probably one as well, possibly the police, where you're dealing with quite intense things. You're dealing with other people's trauma quite a lot if you're practicing in crime and family. And you have to retain your kind of professional armour. And but underneath it, you are still affected by it. And so I think a lot of people, the kind of cliche about a barrister or surgeon, frankly, going home and opening a bottle of red wine has probably come around for a very good reason.
It's a release.
Yeah. It's a release. I mean, you probably remember the large adverts in Council magazine, which would be, you know, at AA or, you know, Helpline. Are you drinking too much? Do you remember
that? I mean, I don't remember them from a personal point of view, but I'm aware they were there.
Yeah.
And now you have two little boys.
Yeah.
Has the way you eat and cook changed since you've had them?
Hugely, yeah. Because you feel massively responsible for someone else's input. I think one of the biggest things for me is eating sitting down, because I've spent so long eating standing up. So when you're kind of literally on your feet all day, it's all about efficiency.
Yes.
What can I do as quickly as possible to be able to create more time for myself? And sitting down at a table and eating is massively important. And I want my kids to know how to do that, and I want to do it with them. So that's the biggest change. And also just being much more aware about where what I'm buying comes from and what has gone into a dish, and what them seeing food created from scratch.
Yeah.
I mean, saying that, I'm very happy with a cook microwave meal. We've just done, as Liz knows, a massive house renovation. I had no kitchen for 6 months. So I've discovered all sorts of things you could do in a microwave.
Maybe that's the next book, Microwave Cookbook.
There's already one out there. It's called Meal in a Mug. It's really good. I did a muffin. I mean, it's really good.
You mentioned sort of traumatic cases, and one of the things you've obviously worked quite a lot on is in the family courts and dealing with young mothers. I mean, how has that been? And I mean, presumably you've seen a bit about sort of how they eat and feed their children.
Yeah, and it comes up quite a lot, nutrition, I think, in family, when you're looking at welfare, I guess. And it's a really thorny subject, because it comes back to exactly what we talked about already, which is that bad food is cheap and good food is expensive. And I guess a lot of the cases I would see would be multi-generational. So the parents that I represented didn't necessarily have a good blueprint themselves. So I don't know how you can expect someone to, off their own volition, teach themselves how to cook. It's hard. I mean, it's easier now than it ever has been, because you can look it up in a way that you would never had to kind of generations, never could generations before. But it still requires, I think, eating well still requires planning and preparation, because if you're going to cook a big meal, then if you're going to marinate something or prepare something, or even if it's just you're making a pie and you make the dough and then have to put it in the fridge for an hour or something to cool. It is.
Yeah.
So you have to be organised and you have to think ahead. And a lot of the people, both in criminal and family areas, and Liv's no doubt had the same experience, lived relatively chaotic lives where the idea of what they were going to eat in a week's time was not the first thing on the agenda. The first thing on the agenda is making sure they had enough money for heating that night, or how they were going to get on the bus to court tomorrow. So I think food falls quite far down the list, which is, when you're looking at kind of the illnesses that are affecting a lot of the kids at the moment, is really prevalent, because our obesity levels are very high. And I think our allergy levels, although that might have something to do with pollution, but there's an impact between what we put in our bodies. So I think, like every complicated question, there's a really complicated answer to it. I don't think you can just do a soundbite.
Here's how we fix
Jamie Oliver's
it.
Trying it now. Yeah. But no, I think, you know, the Jack Munro, isn't it, as well, has done a brilliant cookbook about eating on a shoestring, because she's done exactly
that. And she's also done, she's got this new book out about cooking from tin cans, which I think is particularly useful, because we talk about how expensive can it be to buy fresh vegetables? Well, fresh vegetables rot.
Yes.
And freezer meals don't.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you have to prepare fresh vegetables in a way that you don't have to prepare freezer meals. So if you have no cookery education, you are suddenly expected to do a lot more. Whereas if we're doing something that is essentially putting different tin cans, which have an extraordinarily long shelf life, and which are often full of protein, together for children, then we're already halfway there.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a responsibility that I think we kind of have to create recipes that can be adopted by lots of different people.
Yeah, the virtue narrative isn't helpful to the people who need it.
It's not.
Well, they've got more important things to
think
about.
Yeah, they kind of have.
Yeah.
I mean, is this something you said, nutrition comes up in court? Is it something that, you know, a judge might sort of pass judgment on if a mother's not cooking properly?
Not in my experience specifically, but you'll find it maybe coming up in a assessment by a social worker about there not being any food in the fridge, not being any food in the cupboards. You know, one of the things that social workers will look for in terms of whether a child should remain with its family is, are they prepared? And cupboard inspections, I can imagine being one of the most humiliating things ever happening to you, a social worker turning up and opening your cupboards and seeing what's in there and is there anything to eat that night? And it would come up in that context.
Turning to more frivolous matters, because we've talked...
It's all about balance.
Yes, exactly. Everything's about balance, just like eating. No, turning to more frivolous matters, do you have a comfort food or a comfort dish that you rely on?
Well, depends if I'm making it. Because I am, as discussed, not that organised. Very complicated things like massive ottolenghi salads and stuff like that. I will always order that at a restaurant. I'll always like go through the menu and think, what couldn't I definitely make? Definitely buy the thing that there's not a cat's chance in hell of me making at home. So if I'm eating out, it will be like a comfort food will be something kind of exotic and I'll take pleasure in that. But at home, my comfort food really is baked eggs, I think. I love eggs. I use eggs all the time for different things. And I stumbled across, I mean, it took me a long time to understand that recipes work. Not growing up in a home where cooking was a big priority. I think it wasn't until my 20s that I understood. I had sort of, you know, when you define yourself as I'm a maths person or an English person or this, but I was a not cooking person. And then I realised when I moved to London in my early 20s doing pupillage that recipes work. If you follow the recipe and you weigh it and you cook it for the time that they've said, it's amazing. Obviously, it was Delia. It was my gateway recipe
into cooking. The most reliable.
The most reliable. And I was like, God, this is genuinely a revelation. And I think what was then really interesting is that as soon as you work out that most recipes work, then you can start doing things that when you flick through the book, you think, oh, I could never do that. And then you think, well, maybe I could do that because they've told me how to do it. And so you do. Mm-hmm. And it's constantly astonishing to me that as someone who has always defined themselves as not a cooking person,
you can cook.
That I can cook. And I wish that I'd learned that earlier, but also I wish that more people knew that, because it is really rewarding. It's really rewarding to make food for other people. I find it really rewarding. And I love supper parties and I love having people over for dinner. And I do think that the food makes a difference as to the success of the evening, no matter how fun everyone is. I think if you've done something special for them that they like, it's incredibly rewarding and lifts everybody and it's nice.
So what's your fail-safe supper party dish?
Probably something like a kind of something lamb based. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have... My husband's very good at this. He's cooked the last two.
Oh, really?
You tend to eat about 10:30.
But it's delicious.
But it's really
worth the wait.
And by then you're so drunk anyway.
Quite a tactic.
Yeah. No, he's very good at it. He's very good at it.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
And Sarah's book, In Your Defence, Stories of Life and Law, is out now in paperback. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. And for more food and drink, recipes and reviews, head to the Spectator Life website.